that is what the establishment in this political moment fear the most. They fear that we will step outside that system of managed democracy, that political theater, and find our own voice and our own power. And they're frightened. And they will work very, very hard to sell you once again the mantra of the least worst. But look at our own history. Every time we vote for the least worst, it gets worse. It doesn't work.
That was Chris Hedges with some wise thoughts on the phony elections now being staged by the rulers of our managed democracy. Those are strong words, and I wouldn't have said them 10 years ago. Chris Hedges would have, and did. And he'll say it again this week in part two of his recent speech in Seattle, The Algebra of Revolution. This is Kenneth Doust, and I welcome you to New World Notes. This is the 12th presidential election in which I am eligible to vote. Once again, the establishment is urging me to hold my nose and vote for the less terrible of the two right-wing, warmongering big party candidates. Thanks, but no thanks. I did that the first 7 times, and I quit doing that at the end of the 20th century. I'm not advising what you should do this November, so I'll just end with the words of that great moral philosopher, Jiminy Cricket. Let your conscience be your guide. Chris Hedges is a pretty good moral philosopher, too. He was the son of a Christian minister, Presbyterian, I think, a minister whose career suffered when he stood up for just but unpopular causes. For instance, gay rights before that became popular. Son Chris was educated at the best schools, on scholarship, of course, including Harvard Divinity School. After he received his Master of Divinity degree, he became an overseas war correspondent for the New York Times. So he's read a lot and observed a lot and thought a lot about both. Like his father, Chris has been willing to fight for what's right as he sees it, and he's got the arrest record to prove it. Some of this he talks about in today's installment. Let us return to Chris Hedges and The Algebra of Revolution.
Alexander Berkman wrote an essay called The Idea is the Thing, which I use a little bit of in the new book. He writes that when a ruling class, when its ideology loses its credibility, whether that's the divine right of kings or Luther challenging the hegemony of the Catholic Church, the superstructure or the facade of power remains in place. But you begin a process of ferment. He likens it to water boiling in a kettle. So that at the end you see the steam and you hear the whistle, but you've not watched that process of ferment. And I think that's what we're seeing now within this election campaign. This deep frustration, and I would say it is a frustration which people have every right to, being expressed against a closed political establishment. Now, the Democratic Party, it looks, has successfully locked out Sanders. Within the Republican Party, if Trump does not get that first ballot, it appears that they are quite willing to disembowel themselves to prevent him from getting the nomination. And my criticism of Sanders from the beginning, and it's something that I have spoken to him about, is that he tried to run within the confines of the Democratic Party. And his argument, and he wasn't incorrect, was that if he ran as an independent, he would end up like Nader. And he's right. If he challenged the Democratic Party in a meaningful way, the Democratic Party would use their considerable resources to turn him into a pariah, as Dennis Kucinich was, within the Congress, to mount a serious challenge against him in terms of a Senate seat in Vermont. And he did not want to be pushed into the political wilderness. Of course, the corporate media, which hasn't been very good to him anyway, would shut him out. So he was correct in that he would not suffer the retribution of the party and he would have a platform. But my fear is that at a certain moment, because he's within that structure, he is going to take the enthusiasm and the energy and attempt to direct it towards the Clinton campaign. And at that point, he becomes an impediment to everything we must build. We are not going to build a movement outside of the formal structures of power in an election cycle. Syriza started polling at 4% 10 years later they took power in Greece. And that's how we have to begin to think, to free ourselves from the highs and lows of American culture. We have to stand fast around these moral imperatives. We have to begin to build a movement by which power is frightened of us. Karl Polanyi, in The Open Society and Its Enemies, he says, the question is not how do you get good people to rule. Most people, Polanyi writes, who are attracted to power are at best mediocre and usually venal. The question is how do you make the powerful frightened of you? So as Ralph points out, our last liberal president was Richard Nixon. Not because he was a liberal or had a conscience, but because he was frightened of movements. I saw that for the book Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, I was down in West Virginia with a guy named Ken Heckler, who was in Congress, and unlike the current politicians from West Virginia, didn't work for the coal companies. And he authored and got on Nixon's desk the black lung compensation legislation. And Nixon didn't want to sign it. And Heckler told me he got up and held a press conference and said, if the president doesn't sign it, there will be a nationwide coal strike tomorrow, and this country will be thrown into an energy crisis. And Nixon signed it that night. And Heckler said, I didn't really know if there was going to be a... That's how power works. There's a scene in Kissinger's memoirs. Do not buy the book. And Nixon has taken empty city buses end to end around the White House. And there's tens of thousands of anti-war demonstrators. And Nixon's wringing his hands, looking out the window, going, Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us. And that's just where we want people in power to be. That's our job as citizens. And the job of corporate politicians, and I'm going to have to include Obama, is to deliver credulous voters before the altar of corporate power. And Ron Suskind, his book Confidence Men, which is the inside story of the Obama collusion with Wall Street, points this out, that Obama meets with the CEOs of Wall Street, Suskind reports, early on in his presidency, and says the only thing between you and the pitchforks is me. And in the book, at one point, Suskind's interviewing a corporate executive and asks him why they keep criticizing Obama when Obama gives them everything they want, and they say, oh, no, we have to keep criticizing him because that's how we keep him off balance so that he'll always give us what we want. The fact that we have allowed Wall Street to build a financial system that, in essence, counts debt as income, that has created a mechanism where they borrow money at virtually 0% interest, and then, especially if we're late on our credit cards, loans it back to us at 28% interest. I don't think that's capitalism. I don't know what it is, extortion. But it's not a sustainable system. Michael Hudson, in his new book, writes that there have been societies, including the end of the Roman Empire, where speculators have seized power. But he said what's unique about neoliberalism or globalization is that we're the first society who actually argues that debt is a form of wealth creation. And you have created a parasitic class that in essence is making its money by throwing larger and larger sections of the population into debt peonage, and in particular students. There's a reason wages don't rise. There's a reason college tuitions continue to skyrocket. And courtesy of this Congress, students who borrow money will eventually pay more interest than if they'd taken it from a bank. And debt peonage, of course, is always a form of social control, as any African American understands. And so we stand at the moment facing some deep, frightening forces. We have watched our capitalist democracy be transformed, largely through the courts, into what the philosopher Sheldon Wolin calls inverted totalitarianism, and by that he means it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. And that in a classical totalitarian regime, you have a party that creates new symbols, new vocabulary, new mechanisms of control. In inverted totalitarianism, you have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to the Constitution, the iconography and language of American patriotism, electoral politics, and yet internally have seized the levers of power to render the citizen impotent. It's a faceless system, as Hannah Arendt writes in Origins of Totalitarianism. And the courts are used to strip us of our rights by reinterpreting our constitutional guarantees so that Citizens United becomes a way to petition the government or a form of free speech. All of the challenges, the legal challenges that we have made since the Snowden revelations have come to naught. And we are the most watched, photographed, monitored, eavesdropped population in human history. And when the government watches you 24 hours a day, you cannot use the word liberty. That is the relationship between a master and a slave. And the government knows what's coming. They have run scenario after scenario. The militarization of police forces, Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which, as you heard, I sued Obama in federal court over. This was a section that overturned the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, which prohibited the military from serving as a domestic police force. It was a seismic moment in American history and went virtually uncovered, with the exception of my old employer, the New York Times, who not only covered the trial, but when Judge Catherine B. Forrest ruled in our favor, wrote an editorial praising her decision. But it didn't appear on MSNBC, because it didn't make Obama look good, and it didn't appear on Fox, because it didn't make the Republicans look good. And that section within the NDAA, which is renewed every year, in essence, allows the government to carry out acts of extraordinary rendition on the streets of American cities to seize U.S. citizens deemed to be terrorists, hold them indefinitely in military facilities, and strip them of due process. And Judge Forrest, in her 112-page opinion, wrote that this, in essence, gives the government the ability to criminalize an entire category of people and strip them of their rights. And she brought up the 110,000 Japanese Americans who were interned in World War II. And it was instructive of the failure of our court system, not just to defend the rights of citizens, but the Constitution itself, that her ruling created a terrible dilemma. The Obama administration appealed. They didn't just appeal. They appeared at her chambers the day she issued a temporary injunction invalidating that law. And they said, you must put it back into effect immediately in the name of national security. And instead of the federal attorneys, they now had attorneys from the NSA. And Judge Forrest, to her credit, refused. That was a Friday. 9 a.m., Monday morning, they were in the Second Circuit Appellate Court making the same request, and unfortunately, the Appellate Court agreed. Why? Why? We knew they'd appeal. And the only assumption that the attorneys and I could make was that they're already using the law, that there are most probably U.S. Pakistani dual nationals in black sites somewhere. And if that injunction was allowed to stand, if they got out, they could hold the government in contempt of court. Now, what did the Second Circuit do? And this was a window, or is a window, into how our judicial system has become a wholly owned subsidiary of the corporate state. They held a hearing, and then they wouldn't rule for months. And they waited. I was a plaintiff before the Supreme Court. This was before the Snowden revelations, in a case called Clapper versus Amnesty International, where I and other journalists had challenged the government on wholesale wiretapping. And the federal attorneys got up, the government attorneys at the Supreme Court, and they said, we had no right to bring this charge because the charge that the government was carrying out surveillance was, in their words, speculation. And then they added that if we were being watched by the government would tell us. And so the Supreme Court threw the case out, and the Second Circuit said, look, Hedges doesn't have standing in Clapper versus Amnesty International, therefore he doesn't have standing in Hedges versus Obama. And it became law. In case after case, and we haven't begun to talk about the system of mass incarceration, where 94% of the people in our prisons, we have, of course, 25% of the world's prison population with 5% of the world's population, 94% never go to trial. So in that sense, technically, they're innocent because they never had a chance. And as anyone who works in a prison will tell you, those who habitually have the longest sentences are those who went to trial. Because as Michelle Alexander points out, the system is not designed to provide trial by jury. It's designed to offer plea agreements. And the students that I have with the longest sentences are usually the ones who didn't commit the crime because they naively, because they were innocent, believed that they could go to a court and find justice. But what happens is that the 15 charges, because in a plea agreement they'll knock off so many, you get charged with all of them. And that's one of the reasons I teach in a prison, is because these people have no illusion about what's happened to our country. They understand power. They understand what Hannah Arendt calls omnipotent policing. She writes about it as a woman who has become stateless. She's picked up by the Gestapo, held for 3 weeks, almost killed. She almost doesn't make it out. ends up in France without a passport. And she sees the way the French police treat people like her, who have no rights as French citizens, indeed have been stripped of their citizenship entirely. And in The Origins of Totalitarianism, she said, when you create a segment of your population that has no rights, rights become privileges. And when rights become privileges, they can be taken away. And that's exactly what's happened in our poor communities of color, where police serve as judge, jury, and executioners. In most of these trials, it's the word of the police against you. So that there is both a legal mechanism and a physical mechanism in poor communities of color that essentially allows the state to govern under what can only be described as martial law, including the indiscriminate use of lethal force against unarmed citizens. And Arendt warns that if a society devolves and there is unrest and instability, that legal and physical mechanism of omnipotent policing instantly can spread. I have children, and I'm terrified about the world that they will inherit, environmentally, politically. I was a war correspondent for 20 years. I know violence, and I hate violence. I don't believe in just war. Once you employ violence, it's a poison. And that is the focus of my book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. I believe, as Father Daniel Berrigan says, that the essence of faith is that the good draws to it the good, at least the good insofar as we can determine it, and then we must let it go. The Buddhists call it karma. Even empirically of everything around us points to the fact that our struggles have been futile. It does not invalidate the struggle for justice. And I think that we have to recover that sense of faith, that belief that we are called to stand on the side of the oppressed, that understanding that when you join the oppressed, you will get treated like the oppressed. And I think human history has borne out that when movements hold fast to a moral imperative, they will not achieve formal positions of power, but they can begin to seismically move the society. I covered the Velvet Revolution with Václav Havel. I was every night in the Magic Lantern Theater with Havel and Klaus and Dinsmore. And Havel's great 1978 essay, The Power of the Powerless, makes this point. He calls it living in truth. And I think that, for those of us who care about justice, have forgotten that it is not our job to take power. It is our job to keep power in check. And let me here commend the activists in Seattle who shut down that highway. And that is what the establishment in this political moment fear the most. They fear that we will step outside that system of managed democracy, that political theater, and find our own voice and our own power. And they're frightened. And they will work very, very hard to sell you once again the mantra of the least worst. But look at our own history. Every time we vote for the least worst, it gets worse. It doesn't work. Every despotic regime that falls, every revolution that succeeds, as Crane Brinton and Jeffrey Davies, the great theorist and revolutionist, pointed out, succeeds when significant sectors of the foot soldiers of the elite, the civil service, the bureaucracy, the police, refuse to defend discredited centers of power. And that is why I believe they passed Section 1021 of the NDAA. They don't totally trust the police to protect them. We went to Pelosi during that two-year battle, and we said, when you renew it, all you have to do is insert into that section that this does not apply to U.S. citizens, and we will drop our lawsuit. But of course they did not, because it was written for U.S. citizens. The Chicago teachers march through the streets. They go to the precinct houses, and the police applaud. I was arrested in front of the White House a couple years ago with 133 others, most all of whom were veterans, protesting the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And as they cuffed us, it turned out those police had been in the National Guard. They'd been in Iraq. They'd been in Afghanistan. And they would whisper, keep protesting. When we were arrested in front of the Congress, as we were being escorted out, one of the police officers turned and said, how do we get money out of politics? And that's why nonviolence is so important, because it is about the good drawing to it the good. And it's not easy, and I am acutely aware of the violence that police employ against the poor, and in particular poor people of color in this country. And yet, at this moment in history, those who hold power are morally bankrupt and have been exposed. And if we can recover the moral force to resist, to carry out sustained acts of civil disobedience, to create third parties outside of the system that give expression to those movements, then we can use the word hope. Thank you.
Chris Hedges, wrapping up The Algebra of Revolution. I have edited the audio for radio broadcast. The original video recording was provided by Pirate TV Seattle. Many thanks for that. And I thank you, too, for listening to New World Notes. On the web, we are at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust advising, illegitimi non carborundum, let your conscience be your guide. We are not powerless, they just want us to feel that way. And please come back again next week. Ciao.